The Orient Express cuts through the winter night, a luxury train carrying passengers from Istanbul to Calais. Among them is Hercule Poirot, the fastidious Belgian detective with his egg-shaped head and magnificent mustache. In the dining car, he observes two curious figures, a young American and an elderly man whose benevolent appearance masks something malevolent. Later, this older man, Samuel Ratchet, approaches Poirot with an unusual request. He believes his life is in danger and offers $20,000 for protection. Poirot refuses with a cutting dismissal. "I do not like your face, M. Ratchet." That night, the train becomes trapped in a snowdrift between Vinkovci and Broad. By morning, Ratchet is found dead in his locked compartment, stabbed 12 times with savage and inconsistent force. The window is open, but the unbroken snow outside proves no one escaped. With the train snowbound and no outside access, the murderer must still be among them. What makes this setup so brilliant is its perfect isolation. The snowdrift doesn't just strand the passengers, it creates a closed universe where conventional rules are suspended. Within this luxurious prison, a new form of justice will emerge. The Orient Express carries an unusually diverse winter group: nervous Mrs. Hubbard, aloof Princess Dragomirov, the handsome Count and Countess Andreni, Italian businessman Foscarelli, Swedish missionary Greta Olsen, Ratchet's secretary McQueen and valet Masterman, American salesman Hardman, and composed governess Mary Debenham with Colonel Arbuthnot. Each passenger has their own travel reason and alibi. As Poirot interviews them, contradictions emerge. Mrs. Hubbard claims someone entered her compartment overnight. Greta Olsen reports seeing Ratchet alive around 10:40 p.m. Princess Dragomirov's maid describes encountering a conductor who matches no actual train staff. Their testimonies form a puzzle challenging even Poirot's legendary little gray cells. These seemingly random travelers, representing different nationalities, classes, and backgrounds, gradually reveal themselves as anything but strangers. Like mosaic pieces, their individual stories will eventually form a complete picture when viewed from the proper perspective. A charred paper fragment in Ratchet's compartment containing "Remember Little Daisy Armstrong?" reveals Ratchet as Cassetti, the kidnapper who murdered Little Daisy Armstrong from a wealthy American family. The Armstrong case was a sensational tragedy. After collecting the $200,000 ransom, Cassetti revealed Daisy had been dead for weeks. The shock caused pregnant Mrs. Armstrong to deliver a stillborn child before dying herself. Colonel Armstrong subsequently committed suicide, and their innocent nursemaid, falsely suspected, also took her own life. Though arrested, Cassetti escaped justice through legal technicalities and wealth, fleeing America to live as Ratchet abroad. This backstory transforms the murder from a simple crime to a moral reckoning. We're no longer asking who killed a man, but who delivered justice to a monster. The emotional weight of the Armstrong tragedy, the deaths of an innocent child, a mother, an unborn baby, a father, and a blameless servant, creates a moral foundation for what follows. Haven't we all wished for justice when the system failed? As Poirot investigates, contradictions emerge. Ratchet spoke no French, yet someone answered the conductor in perfect French. His watch was deliberately set to 1:15, suggesting an earlier murder time. The stab wounds vary dramatically in force and technique, as if delivered by different hands. Poirot uncovers connections between the passengers and the Armstrong case. Countess Andreni is Mrs. Armstrong's sister, Helena Goldenberg. Mary Debenham was the family's governess, Foscarelli their chauffeur, Greta Olsen was Daisy's nurse who still calls her an angel, and Masterman was Colonel Armstrong's Batman during the war. Poirot's solution: all 12 passengers participated in Ratchet's murder, acting as a jury delivering justice the legal system failed to provide. Each person had a connection to the Armstrong family and delivered one stab wound, explaining the inconsistent patterns. 12 ordinary people united not by hatred, but by love for those they lost. The murder wasn't vengeance, but a restoration of balance. 12 wounds, 12 jurors forming a symmetry that transforms a heinous act into something almost sacred. What elevates Murder on the Orient Express beyond a clever puzzle is its profound moral question. When the legal system fails, is vigilante justice ever justified? The 12 passengers unite in their conviction that Cassetti deserved punishment for his crime against an innocent child and the destruction of a family. Poirot, typically a champion of law and order, faces his greatest ethical dilemma. Having solved the case, he must decide whether to reveal the truth. He ultimately chooses compassion, presenting a fictional solution of an outside killer to the authorities. This moral complexity resonates deeply. We understand the conspirators' grief and their sense that conventional justice failed them. The novel asks whether some crimes are so terrible they justified extraordinary measures, a question that remains relevant today. The setting reinforces this moral ambiguity. The Orient Express, traveling between East and West, becomes a liminal space where conventional rules are suspended. Isolated by snow, the train becomes its own closed society, delivering its verdict in the narrow confines of a luxury train car. Every element in Christie's construction serves multiple purposes. The pipe cleaner initially implicates Colonel Arbuthnot before revealing itself as misdirection. The handkerchief marked H points to Helena Andrenier until Princess Dragomiroff claims it protectively. The scarlet kimono appears and vanishes strategically to distract from the crime's true mechanics. The timing is impeccable. The snowstorm isn't merely convenient, it forces the conspirators to adapt while creating the closed environment necessary for Poirot's investigation. The alibis form an impenetrable web, with each passenger vouched for by another conspirator. Christie assembles a societal microcosm, the aristocratic princess, theatrical Linda Arden as Mrs. Hubbard, dutiful servants, professional women, the cosmopolitan count and countess, the bluff colonel, the gregarious Italian, and the loud American. Each contributes unique skills to both the murder plot and its investigation. Despite its famous solution entering popular culture, Murder on the Orient Express continues to captivate readers. Even knowing the outcome, we appreciate Christie's intricate construction, psychological insights, and moral complexity. The novel's central question remains provocative. When conventional justice fails, is collective action justified? The 12 conspirators, wounded by Cassetti's escape from American justice, transform from passengers into a jury delivering their own verdict. As readers, we find ourselves sympathizing with murderers, understanding their grief, admiring their ingenuity, and perhaps even approving their actions. Christie leads us to this moral precipice, challenging our beliefs about justice and revenge. In this snowbound train, Christie created not just a perfect puzzle, but a moral parable, questioning our assumptions about justice and solidarity. The most difficult mysteries aren't about discovering who committed a crime, but deciding what justice truly means. When systems fail, do we accept that failure or take matters into our own hands? The 12 ordinary people on the Orient Express made their choice, and invite us to consider what we might have done in their place.